discovering stories of courage, determination, and hope. Welcome to Faith Radio's On the Road. Now, here's Ryan Thomas.
Life is short, I want to live it well. One life, one story to tell. Life is short, I want to live it well. And you're the one I'm living for.
We are living in a time of extraordinary astronomical exploration and discovery. But how many of us appreciate or even notice our Creator's mind-boggling display of His handiwork in the heavens? In the remarkable book, Starstruck, award-winning professor, author, and a man commonly described as an astronomy rock star, Dr. David Bradstreet invites us to experience God's power and eternal nature in the stars. The heavens' mind-boggling display is the work of the Creator. And now, using rovers and satellites, we're venturing further out into the vastness of space than ever before. David Bradstreet and his co-writer Steve Raby take readers on a guided tour of the biggest story ever, offering both intriguing science lessons and powerful spiritual insight. And this brilliant man joins us today on the road. A blessed day to you, Doctor. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ryan. It's great to be with you.
Sir, I believe you are the first guest we've ever had that has an asteroid named in your honor. That's pretty impressive stuff right there.
It is just a big rock, after all. I don't let it go to my head. But it was an honor to have that done. It was done, you know, basically for the work I've done both in astronomy research as well as education.
And you pointed out before we came on the air today that even having the big rock in space named after you does not preclude you from having to shovel snow.
No, as soon as we're done with this interview, that's where I'm going out to shovel snow. So it's you have a rock named after you, and you still get to do all the fun things of life.
Now, you don't see too many faith-based books dealing with astronomy. Now, why did you want to write Starstruck?
Well, I've been teaching astronomy and physics at Eastern University near Philadelphia for the past 41 years, which sounds, when I say it, it sounds like a lifetime, which I guess it is. I keep running into people who think, they'll ask me, well, how can you be an astronomer and be a Christian at the same time? And so there's a great deal of ignorance about the so-called conflict between science and faith. And we thought that it was time to write a book showing that you can be an evangelical and be a respected research scientist and not have any of these issues. It's really, a misunderstanding of Scripture and a misunderstanding of what science is and what it does. We wrote a book so that, you know, the average person could perhaps see that, wow, we didn't know that people, Christians, think this way.
Oh, it's great. And I had the chance to get from A to Z in the book as well. And it is a fascinating book. And it's written from the perspective that even someone like myself who didn't know many of the concepts when I went in can keep their head above water the entire time. And just a very encouraging book from that perspective. I wonder, you know, as somebody who has become a celebrated individual in your field, is this a fascination, this fascination with the stars and with the heavens, does it stretch back to youth for you, or did you develop it later in life?
No, it really started when I was very small. My brother had what was called the Golden Book of Astronomy. It's a big coffee table book. And when I was 6 or 7, I used to go through this and mostly look at the pictures and read pieces of it. And I was fascinated with this book. So when I was about 8, I thought to myself, well, you know, you like to do this so much. Why don't you do this for a living? And so I decided when I was 8, I wanted to be an astronomer. And so that's the path I took. I had a small telescope. I went out in the backyard in Massachusetts and sat out in the snow and froze and shivered and looked at various objects, and I just fell in love with it.
Wow. What did your friends think about knowing an 8-year-old who knew exactly what he wanted to do when he grew up?
I had lots of friends, and they sort of accepted me as the nerd that I was because I was also the class clown. So it worked out. I mean, I was not the kind of nerd that people didn't like. I was the kind of nerd that got the teacher off balance because of the jokes and stuff. And so the students liked that because they got to do less work in class.
The humor shows up in the book as well. Dr. David Bradstreet is with us today. He's an award-winning professor, astronomer, the author of Starstruck, Seeing the Creator in the Wonders of Our Cosmos. And am I saying the word cosmos correctly? Is it cosmos or cosmos, sir?
Cosmos is the way most people pronounce it, yes.
Okay, cool. That makes me feel better about my life today. Thank you for that. Now, you've said that the more you learn about creation, the more you marvel at the Creator. As someone who has studied this as much as you have, kind of take us into the big picture of what you mean by that when it comes to the heavens.
I think that idea of the more you understand, the more you appreciate is a common thread throughout all of creation. In other words, I know if I go to the Philadelphia Art Museum and I don't understand the artist or the artist's life or what he was trying to portray or what was going on in his lifetime at that moment, what was he experiencing, I'm going to miss the depth and breadth of that artwork. And I think that it's really important as we study the heavens, what that does is we start to see, wow, this is incredible. How did this come to be? And how do stars hold together, and why do they age, and the very strange things that they go through? The more that you find out, the more you discover, number one, that you don't know, and you also discover that it's fascinating, it's intriguing, and what a tremendously genius God we worship.
Hmm. A phrase that you use inside of that concept is intricate simplicity, that creation has an intricate simplicity. Take us inside what that means.
I often give this idea to my students because when I'm teaching astronomy, I try to make it so that they can understand it. Once they understand the principles, then I can get into the more complex ideas that are typically behind those principles. And so, kind of like when you drive your car, you really don't know much of what's actually going on inside the car, especially nowadays with electronics and computers running the car.
Yeah.
So that the car driving the car is simple, but there's a tremendous amount of complexity and technology behind it. That's the way the universe is. We can come up with principles that are relatively straightforward, but they're masking a tremendous amount of intricacy, complexity, and what I would call beauty. That the universe, that's the way it runs. And so that's what I mean by intricately simple. Hmm. Ideas that a child can begin to understand. And yet as you get more into it, you realize, whoa, this is like a lifetime of study. But theology is no different.
Hmm.
Understanding that the life of Christ, the sacrifice of Christ, these the ideas of sin and the need for a sacrifice and those ideas are simple enough that a child can understand them, and yet theologians spend lifetimes trying to understand the depths of them. It's really related to that idea.
You go along in this book, and there's so much that is brilliant, and then you come to this phrase, Goldilocks, inside the book, and you maybe didn't expect to encounter that. The Goldilocks planet is one of the things that you talk about in terms of the grandeur and just the extraordinary complexity of the universe. Take us inside what that means.
Well, of course, it refers back to the famous fairy tale about Goldilocks and the Three Bears. And she's basically a troublemaker, and she breaks into their house and finds all these different things for the three different bears, and you know, like the chair, the father's chair is too big and the mother's chair doesn't work, but the baby's chair is just right. And the same with the food, the porridge, etc. She finds one of them is just right. Well, the Earth is the Goldilocks planet in our solar system. Everything seems to be just right or conducive to support life. And so the Earth is just replete with life everywhere you look, even in the deepest oceans. Even in the coldest climates, there's some kind of life.
Yeah.
And so the Earth is placed in a place called the habitable zone around our sun, where water can exist in large amounts in liquid form. And so we believe that's a necessary ingredient for life to develop. But it's much more than that. The Earth's tilt, which gives us our seasons, that's not just happenstance in the sense of, okay, the Earth is tilted. God must have been a little tipsy when he made the Earth. Not that at all. It's that the Earth's tilt, which gives us seasons, actually moderates the global climate so that the sun isn't pounding down on the equator all the time, so that the tropics are not as hot as they would be. Imagine if the Earth was just pounding down on the equator and the tropics steadily for the entire year. That part of the Earth would get very, very warm and hot. And then the polar regions would be very cold, and we'd have hurricanes and storms at the interclash of those two climate zones. So the climate of the Earth would be a mess. But because we're tilted, the climate gets mitigated, moderated through the year, and makes it as pleasant as it actually is.
Man, fascinating stuff today on the road with Dr. David Bradstreet, an award-winning professor, astronomer, the author of Starstruck, Seeing the Creator in the Wonders of Our Cosmos. Now, one of the contentions you made right off the top is that one of the real messages of this book is that science and faith do not have to be at war. Why is that something that you really wanted to delve into, something that continued to be on your heart?
Well, I would contend that theology, which is supposed to be the study of God, and God is truth, science is really looking for truth. So truth is truth. You can't have your own truths. You know, something that's true in the Bible should also be true in God's creation, what we call the book of nature. And so if you understand Scripture properly and if you understand nature properly, those things cannot conflict. And so I think it's important, and history has taught us that some of the best scientists in the early, when science really started getting going in the 17th and 18th centuries, these scientists were devout Christians. God was critically important in their lives, and what they believed, like Kepler, was that they were worshiping God by studying his creation. And as Kepler said, you know, he was thinking God's thoughts after him. And he took tremendous relish in that idea that God was revealing to him things that no human had ever seen before. And starting to realize that, wow, the universe runs on what we call mathematical equations. That's just awesome. And so what I'm trying to do is to get people to not be afraid of science. And I'm trying to get scientists to not be afraid of the Bible. And try to get these groups together and start talking to each other, not yelling at each other.
You do continue to talk about history that looks at the interaction of faith communities and the scientific community. You talk about Galileo, the astronomer, as well, someone that I know you know a great deal about. And, of course, there was a conflict between Galileo and the church at the time. Why do you spend time recounting that story in the book?
Well, it's interesting. Galileo was a Catholic, and so he was under authority to the Pope. And Galileo, as he invented, so to speak, the telescope, he actually borrowed the idea from a Dutch lens maker, Hans Lippershey. But he was the first to really start reporting his astronomical discoveries, and it became very clear to him that the ideas of the Earth being the center of the universe and everything going around the Earth, these ideas were starting to become impossible or in conflict with the observations he was making, especially the planet Venus, for example. And so he took the bold step of writing a pamphlet in Italian, so that everyone could read it. And in those days, if you were writing a scholarly work, it was always done in Latin. But he wrote it in the common tongue so everybody could be made aware of these discoveries. And the church basically tried to clamp down on it, not because what he was saying wasn't true, but because they were starting to realize that, good grief, our beliefs about an Earth-centered universe probably aren't right, but we've been pushing them for 1,500 years. We can't just come out and say, oh, by the way, we've been wrong for 1,500 years. So they wanted to break the news slowly. And Galileo, of course, is like, what's the problem? This is the way it is. The Copernican idea is correct. Let's just tell people and move on. And so his brash personality and being a little bit smarter than everybody else in the room, that actually didn't help him.
Hmm.
And so he was put before the Inquisition, shown the instruments of torture, and at 70 years old, which in those days was quite old, he said, "Okay, I'm going to recant because it's not worth torture."
Man.
And so, of course, the Catholic Church has since forgiven him. John Paul II forgave him in 1980, which was, I thought, was a nice thing to do. Almost 400 years later. But this is a good example of, you know, science and the church in conflict, mostly because one side won't listen to the other, even though the other side has. The Vatican astronomers knew that Galileo was correct.
Amazing.
That really wasn't the issue. It was more of a political issue.
It's amazing. And there are tentacles of that story that even ring true today. I want to ask you about that in just a moment. Dr. David Bradstreet is an award-winning professor, astronomer, the author of Starstruck, Seeing the Creator in the Wonders of Our Cosmos. I thought alongside that, you made a pretty fascinating point in a recent interview that you did with Bible Gateway when you said that even the most compelling presentation of the scientific case for God isn't necessarily going to convince the most committed atheist that God exists. And yet, it's absolutely worthwhile. It's just, I took your statement to mean there's something to knowing the limits of even what our knowledge and what our discovery can do, and knowing, of course, the great power of God and the Holy Spirit to convince.
Well, it's very important, and I'm not crazy about it, but again, the scriptures make it clear that it's impossible to please God except through faith. And so there's no way to prove that God exists. I think God himself has made it that way. And so you can put forward all kinds of evidence which you think points towards God, but ultimately you're going to have to take that leap of faith. And I don't quite understand that. I'm not mature enough or wise enough to understand why God wants it that way. But
yeah.
It's obvious that he does, and so I can't prove to people that God exists or that he doesn't exist.
Hmm.
But I believe that the evidence can be looked at in such a way that, to me, it's pretty much of a closed case that he not only exists, not only created the universe, but upholds it, sustains it in all ways. But that's a faith statement. That's not a scientific statement.
You take the time to delve into some of the most buzzed about topics under debate in science today, and even among lay people who wouldn't necessarily know the ins and outs of all of these debates. They're just fascinated by it. One of the things in that realm that you talk about is dark matter. What is dark matter, and how does it play into all this in your message?
Well, I think that dark matter was discovered in the early part of the 20th century as when they started looking at galaxies moving within clusters. There are actually not only clusters of stars in our Milky Way, but galaxies themselves form in clusters. And when these clusters were looked at and the velocities of these things measured, they were moving far too fast within their individual groupings to stay together. And yet they stayed together, meaning that the gravity holding them together had to be much stronger than the apparent size and mass of those galaxies exhibited. And so it's like, well, what's holding them together? The same is true with the Milky Way. The Milky Way is rotating a lot faster than would be expected and still hold together, yet it holds together with no problem. And so this idea of missing or dark matter has come up in the early part of the 1900s and has continued now, that there must be. In fact, the idea now is that 90% of all matter in the universe may not be giving off light and hence be dark matter. So that's kind of a mind-blowing thing. I mean, where is all this dark matter?
Yes.
Now, I thought it might be missing socks as part of it, but maybe there's not enough of my socks missing to do that. But you know, if it's on a serious note, if it's really 90% of the mass in the universe is unseen, what in the world could this be? And where is it? And what is it composed of? And so there's certainly matter that we can't see, matter that doesn't give off visible light, but we still don't know what it is.
Wow.
And so this is why I love astronomy. I mean, there's you're always bumping into mysteries, things that you didn't even know about. And as you look deeper in, you find, boy, I don't really know much of anything. Isn't this true? This is what Socrates said back in Athens. He considered himself to be the stupidest man in Athens. And he asked all these questions, and people were upset at him because his questions revealed that they knew even less.
Hmm.
And so the more you learn, that's supposed to bring humility, not pompousness. Because you start to realize, good grief, I don't really know much of anything. I tell my students, go walk in the library and ask yourself, how many of these books have you read? And can so consider all the knowledge that you're not even aware of.
Remarkable stuff. What a great, great word, a great conversation with Dr. David Bradstreet today. His book is called Starstruck, Seeing the Creator in the Wonders of Our Cosmos. And we just have, several minutes left. I know that one of the most buzzed about conversations when it comes to space, when it comes to the heavens, always is E.T. out there somewhere? Is that plausible? Do you have an opinion on that?
I have opinions on everything, Ryan. I tease my students when I show them pictures of the Earth, and I'll say to them, have we discovered intelligent life on the Earth yet? And they sit there and they think about that. It's hard to know. It could go either way, but the interesting thing is the answer to that question, whether it's yes or no, is mind-boggling. Let's say that we're the only intelligent life in the entire universe.
Okay.
Think of what that means. With the universe that's billions and billions of light years in size, which is inconceivable, frankly, to humans, we're the only intelligent life that God has created? Now, that's possible. If so, then we better take good care of this Earth and good care of each other, because that's a big universe and we're it. So that is a possibility. It is a possibility. On the flip side, for the God who makes every snowflake differently, is it not possible that he has sheep that we know not of? As he said to his disciples in reference to the Gentiles. And so is our God who's infinite, is it not possible that he's created many civilizations on many worlds that worship him? And that's mind-blowing, too, because our God has to be universal. God has to be God or he isn't God.
Yeah.
He has to be infinite.
Yeah.
And so our God has to be their God. So what does that mean? I mean, it would be like, again, the Europeans felt the same way. They discovered the New World. It's like, good grief, what is this? And what are these people doing here?
Yeah.
And so that really shook up the church, because it was like, wow, we don't find this in the Bible. Hmm. And so if extraterrestrials come and land on the White House lawn and say, here we are, bring us the Burger King, how is the church going to react to that if that happens? And maybe they'll come and try to evangelize us. So it's a fascinating question. It's fun to talk about. But it's also possible that we're it. That is a possibility. And quite frankly, that to me blows my mind even more, that if we're the only beings in creation that God has made that has the ability to say no to him. All the rest of the universe obeys his laws without question. But he made us like him, and so we have the choice to say no, much to his chagrin, and frankly ours.
Well, you don't get the treat of having a conversation like this too often. We're so grateful for your time, Dr. David Bradstreet, award-winning professor, astronomer, the author of Starstruck, Seeing the Creator in the Wonders of Our Cosmos. And before we say farewell, we, of course, want to discover how we can learn more about you, your ministry, your incredible scholarship, as well as where can we go to buy the book, sir?
Well, you can go to any reputable bookstore. You can buy it on Amazon, christianbook.com, Barnes & Noble. And if you want to go online and check out what I do at Eastern University, the website is euastronomy.com. The letter E, the letter U, astronomy.com. And you can find out all about the book and our observatory, our planetarium, and all the crazy stuff that we do at Eastern University.
Well, it really has been a privilege to talk with you today, sir. The brilliance, the scholarship, and also the rather whip-smart wit as well. It was so good to have you. Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you, Ryan. It's been great fun.
Thanks for sharing in the story of this latest episode of Faith Radio's On the Road. For more on today's conversation and the full podcast archive of all our episodes, look for On the Road when you visit myfaithradio.com.